Even an associate professor of ophthalmologic surgery at the Wilmer Eye Institute of the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Jack's mouth tasted like toothpaste and cheap white wine, but the rest of him smelled like a man, the man who'd made her life into a dream. Mostly a dream. He was working too hard, drinking too much, not sleeping enough. But underneath all that was her man. And they didn't come any better. Weaknesses, absences, and all. Kathy made the proper noises when Jack's hands found the buttons. He got the message, but his fingers were clumsy. Annoying, the buttons were small and in those damn little fabric loops. But behind the buttons and the fabric were her breasts, and that fact ensured that he would not stop. Kathy took in a deep breath and smelled her favorite dusting powder. She didn't like perfume. A woman generated all the smells a man needed, she thought. There. Now his hands found her bare, smooth, and still young skin. 36 was not old, not too old for one more child. One more was all she craved, one more time to feel a new life growing within her. She'd accept the stomach upsets, the compressed bladder, the odd discomfort that merely gave detail to the wonder and the miracle of new life. The pain of birth. It was not fun, not at all, but to be able to do it, to have Jack at her side as he'd done with Sally and little Jack, it was the most profound act of love that she had ever known. It was what being a woman meant, to be able to bring life to the world, to give a man the only kind of immortality that was, as he gave it to her. And besides, she thought with a suppressed giggle, getting pregnant beat the hell out of jogging as a form of exercise. Jack's hands removed her garment completely and eased her onto the bed. He was good at this, always had been, from their first nervous time, and at that moment she'd known that he would ask for her hand, after he'd sampled the other parts. Another giggle of past and present as his hands slid over skin that was now both hot and cold to the touch. And when he'd asked, when he'd worked up the courage, she'd seen the fear in his eyes, the terror at the possibility of rejection, when she was the one who had worried, even cried once for a week that he might not ask, might change his mind, might find someone else. From before their first lovemaking, Kathy had known. This was the one. Jack was the man with whom she would share her life, whose children she would bear, whom she would love to the grave, maybe beyond, if the priests were right. It wasn't his size or his strength, not even the bravery he'd had to show twice in her sight. And, she suspected, more than that in other places she'd never know about. It was his goodness, his gentleness, and a strength that only the perceptive knew about. Her husband was in some ways ordinary, in others unique, but in all ways a man, with all the strengths and few of the weaknesses. And tonight, he would give her another child. Her cycle, predictable as always, was confirmed by her morning temperature. Well, she admitted, it was mainly a statistical probability, but a very high probability in her case. Mustn't get too clinical, not with Jack, and not at a time like this. Her skin was on fire now. Jack was so good at this. His kisses both gentle and passionate, his hands so wonderfully skilled. He was wrecking her hair, but that didn't matter. Surgical caps made perms a waste of time and money. Through the scent of the dusting powder now came the more significant smells of a woman who was nearly ready. Ordinarily, she was more of a participant in these episodes, but tonight she was letting Jack take complete charge, searching over her silky skin for the interesting parts. He liked that occasionally. He also liked it when she played a more active role. More than one way to do this. It came almost as a surprise. Kathy arched her back and whimpered the first time, not really saying anything. It wasn't necessary. They'd been married long enough that he knew all the signals. She kissed him hard and wantonly, digging her nails into his shoulders. That signal meant now. But nothing happened. She took his hand, kissed it, and moved it down so that he would know that she was ready. He seemed unusually tense. Okay, she was rushing him. Why not let... After all, she'd let him take charge, and if she changed now... She moved the hand back to her breast and was not disappointed. Kathy paid closer attention to him now. Tried to. His skills in exciting her were unchanged. She cried out again, kissed him hard, gasping a little, letting him know that he was the one, that her world centered on him as his centered on her. But still his back and shoulders were tense and knotted. What was the matter? Her hands moved again, running over his chest, pulling playfully on the black hairs. That always set him off, especially as her hands followed the hairy trail down to... What? Jack, what's wrong? It seemed forever before she heard him speak. I don't know. Jack rolled over, away from his wife, onto his back, and his eyes stared in the ceiling. Tired?
I guess that's it. Jack slurred the words. Sorry, honey.
Damn, damn, damn. But before she could think to say something else, his eyes closed. It's the hours he's working, and all that drinking. But it wasn't fair. This was the day. This was the moment, and... You're being selfish.
Kathy rose from the bed and collected her peignoir from the floor. She hung it up neatly before getting another that was fit to sleep in and heading into the bathroom. He's a man, not a machine. He's tired. He's been working too goddamned hard. Everyone has a bad day. Sometimes he wants it and you're not in the mood, and sometimes that makes him a little mad, and it's not his fault and it's not your fault. You have a wonderful marriage, but not a perfect one. Jack's as good a man as you have ever known, but he is not perfect either. But I wanted. I want another baby, and the timing is so right, right now. Kathy's eyes filled with tears of disappointment. She knew she was being unfair, but she was still disappointed and a little angry.
Well, Commodore, I can't knock the service.
Hell, Ron. You expect me to have an old shipmate pick up a rental?
As a matter of fact, yes.
Mancuso snorted. His driver tossed the bags into the back of the Navy Plymouth while he and Jones let themselves into the back.
How's the family?
Great, thank you, Commodore. You can call me Bart now, Dr. Jones. Besides, I just screened for Admiral.
All right, Dr. Ron Jones observed.
Bart, I like that. Just don't call me Indy.
Let's see, the family.
Kim's back in school for her doctorate. The kids are all in school. Daycare, whatever, and I'm turning into a damn businessman.
Entrepreneur, I believe, is the correct term, Mancuso observed.
Okay, be technical.
Yeah, I own a big piece of the company. But I still get my hands dirty. I got a business guy to do the accounting bullshit. I still like to do real work. Last month I was down at Autech on the Tennessee checking out a new system.
Jones looked at the driver.
Okay to talk here?
Petty Officer Vincent is cleared higher than I am. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir. Admiral's always right, sir, the driver observed as he headed off toward Bangor.
You got a problem, Bart.
How big?
A unique problem, Skipper, Jones said, lapsing back to the time when he and Mancuso had done some interesting things aboard USS Dallas. It's never happened before.
Mancuso read his eyes.
Got pictures of the kids?
Jones nodded.
You bet. How are Mike and Dominic doing?
Well, Mike's looking at the Air Force Academy.
Tell him the oxygen rots your brain.
Dominic's thinking Caltech.
No kidding.
Hell, I can help him out.
The rest of the drive occupied itself with small talk. Mancuso swept into his office and closed the soundproof door behind Jones after ordering coffee from his steward.
What's the problem, Ron?
Jones hesitated just a fraction before answering.
I think somebody was tracking Maine.
Track an Ohio? Come on.
Where is she now?
Heading back out to sea, as a matter of fact. Blue Crew is embarked. She links up with a 688 when she clears the strait for some noise checks, then clears to her patrol area. Mancuso could discuss almost anything with Jones. His company consulted on the sonar technology for all submarines and anti-submarine platforms in the U.S. fleet, and that necessarily included a lot of operational information.
Got any Gold Crew guys on base now?
The captain's off on vacation. XO's here, Dutch Claggett. Know him?
Wasn't he on the Norfolk?
Black guy, right?
That's right. I've heard good stuff about him.
He did a nice job on a carrier group on his command quals. I was riding a P-3 when he kicked their ass.
You heard right. He's being deep-dipped. This time next year, he'll be taking command of a fast attack.
Who's his skipper?
Harry Ricks. Heard of him, too?
Jones looked at the floor and muttered something.
I got a new guy working for me, retired chief whose last tour was with Ricks.
Is he as bad as I hear?
Ricks is a super engineer, Mancuso said. I mean it. He's a genius at that stuff.
Fine, skipper. So are you. But does Ricks know how to drive?
Want some coffee, Ron?
Mancuso gestured at the pot.
You might want Commander Claggett here, sir.
Jones rose and got his own coffee.
Since when have you turned diplomat?
Command responsibilities, Ron. I never told outsiders about the crazy stuff you did on Dallas.
Jones turned and laughed.
Okay, you got me there. I have the sonar analysis in my briefcase. I need to see his course tracks, depth records, that stuff. I think there's a good chance Maine had a trailer, and that Bart is no shit.
Mancuso lifted his phone. Find Lieutenant Commander Claggett. I need him in my office at once.
Thank you.
Ron, how sure? I did the analysis myself. One of my people looked it over and caught a whiff. I spent 50 hours massaging the data. One chance in three, maybe more, that she was being trailed.
Bart Mancuso set his coffee cup down.
That's really hard to believe.
I know. That very fact may be skewing my analysis. It is kinda incredible.
It was an article of faith in the United States Navy that its fleet ballistic missile submarines had never, not ever, not once been tracked while on deterrence patrol. As with most articles of faith, however, it had caveats. The location of American missile sub-bases was not a secret. Even the United Parcel Service delivery men who dropped off packages knew what to look for. In its quest for cost efficiency, the Navy mainly used civilian security officers, rent-a-cops at its bases. Except that Marines were used wherever there were nuclear weapons. Wherever you saw Marines, there were nukes about. That was called a security measure. The missile boats themselves were unmistakably different from the smaller fast attack subs. The ship names were on the Navy register, and the sailors of those ships wore ball caps identifying them by name and hull number. With knowledge available to anyone, the Soviets knew where to station their own fast attack boats to catch the American boomers on the way out to sea. At first, this had not been a problem. The first classes of Soviet fast-attack submarines had been equipped with Helen Keller sonars that could neither see nor hear, and the boats themselves had been noisier than unmuffled automobiles. All that had changed with the advent of the Victor III class, which approximated a late American 594 class in radiated noise levels, and began to approach adequacy in sonar performance. Victor III's had occasionally turned up at the Juan de Fuca Strait, and elsewhere, waiting for a U.S. missile sub to deploy, and in some cases, since harbor entrances are typically restricted waters, they had established contact and held on tight. that occasionally had included active sonar lashing, both unnerving and annoying to American subcrews. As a result, U.S. fast attack subs often accompanied missile submarines to sea. Their mission was to force the Soviet subs off. This was accomplished by the simple expedient of offering an additional target for sonar, confusing the tactical situation, or sometimes by forcing the Russian submarine off track by ramming, called shouldering, to defuse that most obscene of marine terms. In fact, American boomers had been tracked, only in shallow water, only near well-known harbors, and only for brief periods of time. As soon as the American subs reached deep water, their tactics were to increase speed to degrade the trailing sub's sonar performance, to maneuver evasively, and then go quiet. At that point, every time, the American submarine broke contact. The Soviet sub lost its track and became the prey instead of the hunter. Missile submarines typically had highly drilled torpedo departments, and the more aggressive skippers would have all four of their tubes loaded with Mark 48 torpedoes with solutions set on the now blinded Soviet sub as they watched them wander away in vulnerable befuddlement. The simple fact was that American missile submarines were invulnerable in their patrol areas. When fast attack boats were sent in to hunt them, care had to be given to operating depths, much like traffic control for commercial aircraft, lest an inadvertent ramming occur. American fast attack boats, even the most advanced 688 class, had rarely tracked missile submarines, and the cases where Ohio's had been tracked could be counted on the fingers of one hand. Nearly all involved a grievous mistake made by the missile boat skippers, the ultimate black mark in the copybook, and even then only a very good and very lucky fast attack skipper had managed to pull it off, and never ever without being counter-detected. Omaha had one of the best drivers in the Pacific Fleet, and he had failed to find Maine despite having some good intelligence data provided, better than anything a Soviet commander would ever get. "Good morning, sir," Dutch Claggett said on his way through the door. "I was right down the hall at personnel." "Commander, this is Dr. Ron Jones." "This the Jonesy you like to brag on, sir?" Claggett took the civilian's hand. "None of those stories are true," Jones said. Claggett stopped cold when he saw the looks. "Somebody die or something?" "Grab a seat," Mancuso said. "Ron thinks you might have been tracked on your last patrol." "Bullshit," Claggett observed.
"Excuse me, sir."
"You're pretty confident," Jones said. "Maine is the best submarine we own, Dr. Jones. We are a black hole. We don't radiate sound. We suck it in from around us." "You know the party line, Commander. Now can we talk business?" Ryan unlocked his briefcase and pulled out a heavy sheaf of computer printouts. "Right around the halfway point in your patrol."
"Okay, yeah. That's when we snuck up behind Omaha."
"I'm not talking about that." "Omaha was in front of you," Jones said, flipping to the right page.
"I still don't believe it, but I'll look at what you got."
The computer pages were essentially a graphic printout of two waterfall sonar displays. They bore time and true bearing references. A separate set showed environmental data, mainly water temperature. "You had a lot of clutter to worry about," Jones said, pointing to notations on the pages. 14 fishing boats, half a dozen deep draft merchant ships, and I see the humpbacks were up to thin out the krill. So your sonar crew was busy, maybe a little overloaded. You also had a pretty hard layer."
"All that's right," Claggett allowed.
"What's this?" Jones pointed to a blossom of noise on the display.
"Well, we were tracking Omaha, and the captain decided to rattle their cage with a water slug."
"No shit," Jones asked.
"Well, that explains his reaction. I guess they changed their underwear and headed north. You never would have pulled that off on me, by the way."
"Think so?"
"Yeah. I think so," Jones replied. "I always paid real good attention to what was aft of us. I've been out on Ohio's, Commander, okay? You can be tracked. Anybody can. It isn't just the platform. Now,
Look here. The printout was a computer-generated cacophony of dots that seemed, for the most part, to show nothing but random noise, as though a convention of ants had walked across the pages for hours. As with all truly random events, this one had irregularities, places where, for one reason or another, the ants had never trod, or places where a large number had congregated and then dispersed. This line of bearing, Jones said. This pattern comes back 8 times, and it comes back only when the layer thins out. Commander Claggett frowned. 8, you say? These 2 could be reverbs from the fishing boats, or really distant CZ contacts. He flipped through the pages. Claggett knew his sonar. This is thin. That's why your people didn't catch it, either aboard or here. But that's why I got the contract to back-check your people, Jones said. Who was out there? Commodore? Claggett asked, and got a nod. There was an Akula class out there somewhere. The P-3s lost him south of Kodiak, so he was within maybe 600 miles of us. That doesn't mean this is him. Which one? Admiral Lunan, Claggett answered. Captain Dubuman? Jesus, you are cleared pretty good, Mancuso noted. They say he's very good. Ought to be. We have a mutual friend. Is Commander Claggett cleared for that? No. Sorry, Dutch, but that is really black. He ought to be cleared for that, Jones said. This secrecy crap goes way too far, Bart. Rules are rules. Yeah, sure. Anyway. This is the one that twigged me. Last page. Ron flipped through to the end. You were coming up to antenna depth. Yeah, practice on the missiles. You made some hull noises. We came up fast, and the hull's made of steel, not elastic, Claggett said in some annoyance. So? So your hull went up through the layer faster than your tail did. Your towed array caught this. Claggett and Mancuso both went very quiet. What they saw was a fuzzy vertical line, but the line was in a frequency range that denoted a Soviet submarine's acoustical signature. It was by no means conclusive evidence, but it, like all the other things Jones had notated, was dead aft of Maine's course. Now, if I was a betting man, which I'm not, of course, I'd give you 2-1 that while you were underneath the lair, someone might have been tooling along just over top, letting his tail hang under it. He caught your hull transient, saw you were going shallow, and ducked under the lair just as you came over it. Cute move, but your big up angle meant that your tail stayed down longer than it should have, and that's where this signature came from. But there's nothing after that. Nothing at all. Jones admitted. It never came back. From there on to the end of the tapes, nothing but random noise and otherwise identified contacts.
It's pretty thin, Ron, Mancuso said, standing up to straighten his back.
I know. That's why I flew out. In writing, it would never sell.
What do you know about Russian sonar that we don't? Getting better. Approaching where we were, 10 or 12 years ago. They pay more attention to broadband than we do. That's changing now. I sold the Pentagon on taking another look at the broadband integration system Texas Instruments has been working on. Commander, what you said before about being a black hole, it cuts both ways. You can't see a black hole, but you can detect it. What if you track an Ohio by what should be there, but isn't?
Background noise.
Yep.
Jones nodded. You make a hole in it. You make a black spot where there's no noise. If he can really isolate a line of bearing on his gear, and if he's got really good filters and one dynamite sonar operator, I think it's possible, if something else cues you in.
That's real thin.
Jones granted that observation. But it's not impossible. I ran the numbers. It's not good, but it's not impossible. Moreover, we can track below ambient now. Maybe they can, too. I'm hearing they've started turning out a new large aperture tail, the one designed by the guys outside Murmansk. Good as a BQR-15 used to be. I don't believe it, Mancuso said. I do, Skipper. It's not new technology. What do we know about Lunan? She's in overhaul right now. Let's see. Mancuso turned to look at the polar projection chart on his office wall. If that was him, then if he headed straight back to base... It's possible, technically speaking, but you're assuming a hell of a lot. I'm saying that this bird was just in the neighborhood when you fired that water slug, that you headed south and so did he, that you gave him a hull transient which he reacted to, and then he broke contact on his own. The data is thin, but it fits. Maybe, I grant you, maybe. That's what they pay me for, guys. I commended Rix for rattling Omaha's cage like that, Mancuso said after a moment. I want aggressive skippers. Jones chuckled to break the tension in the room. I wonder why, Bart? Dutch knows about that job we had on the beach. That pickup we did. That was a little exciting, Jones admitted. One chance in three. The probability increases if you assume the other skipper is smart. Dubyanin had a great teacher. What are you two talking about? Lieutenant Commander Claggett asked in some exasperation. You know we have all sorts of data on the Russian Typhoon class, lots more on their torpedoes. Ever wonder how we got all that data, Commander? Ron, goddammit! I didn't break any rules, Skipper. And besides, he needs to know. I can't do that, and you know it. Fine, Bart. Jones paused. Commander, you may speculate on how we got all that information in one great big lump. You might even guess right. Claggett had heard a few rumbles, like why the 810 dock at Norfolk had been closed so long a few years before. There was a story floated about, spoken only in submarine wardrooms far at sea and well below the surface, that somehow the U.S. Navy had gotten its hands on a Russian missile sub, how a very strange reactor had turned up at the Navy's nuclear power school in Idaho for tests and then had disappeared, how complete drawings and some hardware from Soviet torpedoes had magically appeared in Groton, and how two night missile shots out of Vandenberg Air Force Base had not appeared to be American missiles at all. Lots of operational intelligence had come into the fleet, very good stuff, stuff that sounded like it had come from someone who knew what the hell he was talking about. Not always the case with intelligence information on Soviet submarine tactics and training. Claggett needed only look at Mancuso's uniform to see the ribbon that denoted a Distinguished Service Medal, America's highest peacetime decoration. The ribbon had a star on it, indicating a second such award. Mancuso was rather young for a squadron command, and very young indeed to be selected for Rear Admiral, lower half. And here was a former enlisted man who'd sailed with Mancuso and now called him Bart. He nodded to Dr. Jones. I get the picture. Thanks. You're saying operator error? Jones frowned. He didn't know all that much about Harry Rix. Mainly bad luck. Call it good luck, even. Nothing bad happened, and we've learned something. We know more about the Akula than we used to. A weird set of circumstances came together. Won't happen again in 100 years, maybe. Your skipper was a victim of circumstance, and the other guy, if there was another guy there, was very damned sharp. Hey, the important thing about mistakes is that you learn from them, right? Harry gets back in 10 days, Mancuso said. Can you be back here then? Sorry, Jones said with a shake of the head. I'm going to be in England. I'm going out on HMS Turbulent for a few days of hide-and-seek. The Brits have a new processor that we need to look at, and I drew the duty. You're not going to ask me to present this to the CEO, are you, sir? Claggett asked after a minute's reflection. No, Dutch. You trying to tell me something? It was Claggett's turn to look unhappy. Sir, he's my boss. And he's not a bad boss. But he is a little positive in his thinking. That was artfully done, Jones thought. Not a bad boss. A little positive. He just called his skipper an idiot in a way that no one could ever call disloyal. Ron wondered what sort of hyper-nuke engineer this Rix was. The good news was that this XO had his act together, and a smart skipper listened to his XO. Skipper, how's Mr. Chambers doing? Just took over Key West. Got a kid you trained as his leading sonar man. Billy Zerwinski, just made chief, I hear. Oh, yeah? Good for him. I figured Mr. Chambers was going places. But Billy Z as a chief? What is my Navy coming to?
This is taking forever, Cotty observed sourly. His skin was pasty white. The man was suffering again from his drug treatment.
That is false, Frome replied sternly. I told you several months, and it will be several months. The first time this was done, it took 3 years and the resources of the world's richest nation. I will do it for you in an eighth of that time, and on a shoestring budget. In a few days, we'll start to work on the rhodium. That will be much easier.
And the plutonium, Gone asked.
That will be the last metalwork. You know why, of course.
Yes, Herr Frome. And we must be extremely careful, since when you work with a critical mass, you must be careful that it does not become critical while you are forming it,
Gone replied, allowing his exacerbation to show for a change. He was tired. He'd been at work for 18 hours now, supervising the workers.
And the tritium?
Last of all. Again, the obvious reason. It is relatively unstable, and we want the tritium we use to be as pure as possible.
Quite so.
Gone yawned, barely having heard the answer to his question, and not troubling himself to wonder why Frome had answered as he had. For his part, Frome made a mental note. Palladium. He needed a small quantity of palladium. How had he forgotten that? He grunted to himself. Long hours, miserable climate, surly workers and associates. A small price to pay, of course, for this opportunity. He was doing what only a handful of men had ever done, and he was doing it in such a way as to equal the work of Fermi and the rest in 1944 to 45. It was not often that a man could measure himself against the giants and come off well in the comparison. He found himself wondering idly what the weapon would be used for, but admitted to himself that he didn't care. Not really. Well, he had other work to do. The German walked across the room to where the milling machines were. Here another team of technicians were at work. The beryllium piece now on the machine had the most intricate shape and had been the hardest to program, with concave, convex, and other complex curves. The machine was computer-controlled, of course, but was kept under constant observation through the Lexan panels that isolated the machining area from the outside world. The area was ventilated upwards into an electrostatic air cleaner. There was no sense in just dumping the metallic dust into the external air. In fact, doing so constituted a major security hazard. Over the electrostatic collection plates was a solid 2 meters of earth. Beryllium was not radioactive, but plutonium was, and plutonium would presently be worked on this very same machine. The beryllium was both necessary to the device and good practice for later tasks. The milling machine was everything Frome had hoped for when he'd ordered it several years before. The computer-driven tools were monitored by lasers, producing a degree of perfection that could not have been achieved so quickly as recently as 5 years ago. The surface of the beryllium was jeweled from the machining, already looking like the finish on a particularly fine rifle bolt, and this was only the first stage of machining. The data readout on the machine showed tolerances measured in angstroms.
The tool head was spinning at 25,000 RPM, not so much grinding as burning off irregularities. Separate instruments kept a computer eye on the work being done, both measuring tolerances and waiting for the tool head to show signs of wear, at which point the machine would automatically stop and replace the tool with a fresh one. Technology was wonderful. What had once been the work of specially trained master machinists overseen by Nobel Prize winners was now being done by microchips. The actual casing for the device was already fabricated. Ellipsoidal in shape, it was 98 centimeters in length by 52 in extreme breadth. Made of steel 1 centimeter in thickness, it had to be strong, but not grossly so, just enough to hold a vacuum. Also ready for installation were curved blocks of polyethylene and polyurethane foam, because a device of this sort required the special properties of both the strongest and the flimsiest materials. They had gotten ahead of themselves in some areas, of course, but there was no sense in wasting time or idle hands. On another machine, workers were practicing yet again on a stainless steel blank that simulated the folded cylinder plutonium reaction mass primary. It was their 7th such practice session. Despite the sophistication of the machines, the first two had gone badly, as expected. By number 5, they had figured most of the process out, and the 6th attempt had been good enough to work, but not good enough for Frohm. The German had a simple mental model for the overall task, one formulated by America's National Aeronautics and Space Administration to describe the first moon landing. In order for the device to perform as desired, a complex series of individual events had to take place in an inhumanly precise sequence. He viewed the process as a walk through a series of gates. The wider the gates were, the easier it would be to walk through them quickly. Plus-minus tolerances reflected slight closure of the individual gates. Frohm wanted 0 tolerances. He wanted every single part of the weapon to match his design criteria as exactly as the available technology made possible. The closer to perfection he could get, the more likely it was that the device would perform exactly as he predicted, or even better, part of him thought. Unable to experiment, unable to find empirical solutions to complex theoretical problems, he'd over-engineered the weapon, provided an energy budget that was several orders of magnitude beyond what was really necessary for the projected yield. That explained the vast quantity of tritium he planned to use, more than 5 times what was really needed in a theoretical sense. That carried its own problems, of course. His tritium supply was several years old, and some parts of it had decayed into helium-3, a decidedly undesirable isotope of helium. But by filtering the tritium through palladium, he'd separate the tritium out, ensuring a proper total yield. American and Soviet bomb makers could get away with far less of it because of their extensive experimentation, but Frohm had his own advantage. He did not have to concern himself with a long shelf life for his device, and that was a luxury that his Soviet and American counterparts did not have. It was the only advantage he had over them, and Frohm planned to make full use of it. As with most parts of bomb design, it was an advantage that cut both ways, but Frohm knew he had full control over the device. Palladium, he told himself. Mustn't forget that. But he had plenty of time. Finished. The head of the team waved for Frohm to look. The stainless steel blank came off the machine easily, and he handed it to Frohm. It was 30 centimeters in length. The shape was complex, what one would get from taking a large water tumbler and bending its top outside and down toward the base. It would not hold water because of a hole in the center of what might have been the bottom. Actually, it would, Frohm told himself a second later, just in the wrong way. The blank weighed about 3 kilograms, and every surface was mirror smooth. He held it up to the light to check for imperfections and irregularities. His eyes were not that good. The quality of the finish was easier to understand mathematically than visually. The surface, so said the machine, was accurate to 1/1000th of a micron, or a fraction of a single wavelength of light.
It is a jewel, Gohn observed, standing behind Frohm.
The machinist beamed.
Adequate, was Fromm's judgment. He looked at the machinist. When you've made 5 more equally as good, I will be satisfied. Every metal segment must be of this quality. Begin another, he told the machinist. Fromm handed the blank to Gohn and walked away.
Infidel, the machinist growled under his breath.
Yes, he is, Gohn agreed. But he is the most skilled man I have ever met.
I'd rather work for a Jew.
This is magnificent work, Gohn said to change the subject. I would not have believed it possible to polish metal so precisely. This machine is incredible. I could make anything with it.
That is good.
Make another of these, Gohn told him with a smile.
As you say.
Gohn walked to Cotty's room. The commander was looking at a plate of simple foods, but unable to touch it for fear of retching.
Perhaps this will make you feel better, Gohn told him.
That is, Cotty said, taking it.
That is what the plutonium will look like.
Like glass. Smoother than that. Smooth enough for a laser mirror. I could tell you the accuracy of the surface, but you've never seen anything that small in your life anyway. Fromm is a genius.
He's an arrogant, overbearing...
Yes, Commander, he is all of that, but he is exactly the man we need. I could never have done this myself. Perhaps, given a year or two, perhaps I might have been able to rework that Israeli bomb into something that would work. The problems were far more complex than I knew only a few weeks ago. But this Fromm, what I am learning from him, by the time we are finished, I will be able to do it again on my own.
Really?
Commander, do you know what engineering is? Gohn asked.
It is like cooking.
If you have the right recipe, the right book, and the right ingredients, anyone can do it. Certainly this task is a hard one, but the principle holds. You must know how to use the various mathematical formulae, but they are all in books also. It is merely a question of education. With computers, the proper tools, and a good teacher, which this Fromm bastard is, then why haven't more? The hard part is getting the ingredients, specifically the plutonium or U-235. That requires a nuclear reactor plant of a specific type or the new centrifuge technology. Either represents a vast investment and one which is difficult to conceal. It also explains the remarkable security measures taken in the handling and transport of bombs and their components. The oft-told tale that bombs are hard to make is a lie.
Chapter 18. Progress. Wellington had 3 men working for him. Each was an experienced investigator, accustomed to politically sensitive cases which demanded the utmost discretion. His job was to identify likely areas of field investigation, then to examine and correlate the information they returned to his office in the Justice Department. The tricky part was to gather the information without notice going back to the target of the probe, and Wellington correctly thought that that part of the task would be particularly difficult with a target like Ryan. The DDCI was nothing if not perceptive. His previous job had qualified him as a man who could hear the grass grow and read tea leaves with the best of them. That meant going slow, but not too slow. It also seemed likely to the young attorney that the purpose of his investigation was not to produce data suitable for a grand jury, which gave him quite a bit more leeway than he might otherwise have had. He doubted that Ryan could have been so foolish as to have actually broken any law. The SEC rules had been grazed, perhaps bent, but on inspection of the SEC investigation documents, it was clear that Ryan's action had arguably been made in good faith and full expectation that he had not violated any statute. That judgment might have been technical on Ryan's part, but the law was technical.
The Securities and Exchange Commission could have pushed, and might even have gotten an indictment, but they would never have gotten a conviction. Maybe they could have muscled him into a settlement and or a consent decree, but Wellington doubted that also. They'd suggested it as a sign of good faith, and he had answered with a flat no. Ryan was not a man to tolerate being pushed around. This man had killed people. That didn't frighten Wellington in any way. It was merely an indicator of the man's strength of character. Ryan was a tough, formidable son of a bitch who met things head-on when he had to. That's his weakness, Wellington told himself. He prefers to meet things head-on. He lacks subtlety. It was a common failing of the honest, and a grievous weakness in a political environment. Ryan had political protectors, however. Trent and Fellows were nothing if not canny political craftsmen. What an interesting tactical problem. Wellington saw his task as twofold, to get something that could be used against Ryan, and something that would also neutralize his political allies. Carol Zimmer. Wellington closed one file and opened another. There was a photograph from the Immigration and Naturalization Service. That one was years old. She'd been a child bride in the most literal sense of the word when she'd first come to America, a tiny little thing with a doll's face. A more recent photo taken by his field investigator showed a mature woman still short of 40, her face now showing some lines where once there had been the smoothness of China. If anything, she was more beautiful than before. The timid, almost hunted look in the first photo, understandable since it had been taken after her escape from Laos, had been replaced by that of a woman secure in her life. She had a cute smile, Wellington told himself. The lawyer remembered a classmate in law school, Cynthia Yu. Damn, hadn't she been quite a lay? Same sort of eyes, almost. The Oriental coquette. Might that be it? Something that simple? Ryan was married. Wife, Carolyn Muller Ryan, M.D., eye surgeon. Photo, a quintessential WASP, except that she was Catholic, slender and attractive, mother of two. Well, just because a man has a pretty wife. Ryan had established an educational trust fund. Wellington opened another file. In it was a Xerox copy of the document. Ryan, he saw, had done it alone, through a lawyer. Not his regular lawyer. A D.C. guy. And Carolyn Ryan had not signed the papers. Did she even know about it? The information on his desk suggested that she did not. Wellington next checked the birth records on the newest Zimmer child. Her husband had been killed in a routine training accident. The timing was equivocal. She might have gotten pregnant the very week her husband had been killed. Then again, she might not have. It was her seventh child. Eighth? You couldn't tell with those, could you? Gestation could be 9 months or less. First kids were usually late. Later kids, as often as not, were early. Birth weight of the child, 5 pounds, 7 ounces. Less than average, but she was an Asian, and they were small. Did they have smaller than normal babies? Wellington made his notes, recognizing that he had a series of maybes and not a single fact. But hell, was he really looking for facts? The two punks, Ryan's bodyguards, Clark and Chavez, had mangled one of them. His investigator had checked that out with the Anne Arundel County Police Department. The local cops had signed off on Clark's story. The punks in question had long but minor records, a few summary probations, a few sessions with youth counselors. The cops were delighted at the way things had turned out. Okay with me if he'd shot that worthless little fucker, a police sergeant had said with a laugh recorded on the investigator's tape cassette. That Clark guy looked like one very serious dude. His sidekick ain't much different. If those punks were dumb enough to hassle them, hey, it's a tough world, you know? Two other gang members confirmed the story the way the good guys told it, and that's a closed case, man. But why had Ryan set his two bodyguards on them? He's killed to protect his family, hasn't he? This is not a guy who tolerates danger to his friends, family, lovers. It is possible. Wellington observed to himself. The DDCI is getting a little on the side. Nothing illegal, just unsavory. Also out of character for the saintly Dr. John Patrick Ryan. When his lover is annoyed by some local gang members, he simply sicks his bodyguards on them, like a mafia capo might do, as a lordly public service that no cop would ever bother fooling with. Might that be enough? No. He needed something more. Evidence. Some sort of evidence. Not good enough for a grand jury, but good enough for... what? To launch an official investigation. Of course. Such investigations were never really secret, were they? A few whispers, a few rumors. Easily done. But first, Wellington needed something to hang his hat on.
There are those who say this could be a preview of the Super Bowl. 3 weeks into the NFL season, the Metrodome. Both teams are 2-0. Both teams look like the class of their respective conferences. The San Diego Chargers take on the Minnesota Vikings.
You know, Tony Wills' rookie season has started even more spectacularly than his college career. Only 2 games, and he has 306 yards rushing in 46 carries. That's 6.7 yards every time he touches the ball. And he did that against the Bears and the Falcons, 2 fine rushing defenses, the color man observed. Can anybody stop Tony Wills? And 125 yards in his 9 pass receptions. It's no wonder that they call this kid the franchise. Plus, his doctorate from Oxford University. The color man laughed. Academic All-American, Rhodes Scholar, the man who single-handedly put Northwestern University back on the map with 2 trips to the Rose Bowl. You suppose he's faster than a speeding bullet? We'll find out. That rookie middle linebacker for the Chargers, Maxim Bradley, is the best thing I've seen since Dick Butkus came out of Illinois. The best middle linebacker Alabama ever turned out. And that's the school of Leroy Jordan, Cornelius Bennett, and quite a few other all-pros. They don't call him the Secretary of Defense for nothing. It was already the biggest joke in the NFL, referring to the team owner, Dennis Bunker, the real SecDef.
Tim, I think we got us a ball game.
I should be there, Brent Talbot observed. Dennis is.
If I tried to keep him away from his games, he'd resign, President Fowler said. Besides, he used his own plane.
Dennis Bunker owned his own small jet, and though he allowed others to fly him around, he still maintained a current commercial pilot's license. It was one of the reasons the military respected him. He could try his hand at almost anything that flew, having once been a distinguished combat flyer.
What's the spread on this one?
Vikings by 3, the president answered. That's just because of the home field. The teams are pretty even. I saw Wills against the Falcons last week. He's some kid.
Tony's all of that. A wonderful boy. Smart, marvelous attitude. Spends a lot of time with kids.
How about we get him to be a spokesman for the anti-drug campaign?
He already does that in Chicago. I can call him if you want.
Fowler turned. Do it, Brent. Behind them, Pete Connor and Helen D'Agostino relaxed on a couch. President Fowler knew them both to be football fans, and the president's TV room was large and comfortable.
Anybody want a beer?
Fowler asked. He could not watch a ball game without a beer.
I'll get it, D'Agostino said, heading for the refrigerator in the next room.
It was the most curious thing about this most complex of men, Dagger thought to herself. The man looked, dressed, walked, and acted like a patrician. He was a genuine intellectual with the arrogance to match. But in front of a TV watching a football game, Fowler watched baseball only when his presidential duties required it. He was Joe Sixpack, with a bowl of popcorn and a glass of beer, or 2, or 3. Of course, even here, his "anybody want a beer" was a command.
His bodyguards could not drink on duty, and Talbot never touched the stuff. Daga got herself a Diet Coke. "Thank you," Fowler said when she handed the glass to her president. He was even more polite at football games. Perhaps, D'Agostino thought, because it was something he and his wife had done. She hoped that was true. It gave the man the humanity that he needed above all things.
"Wow! Bradley hit Wills hard enough that we heard it up here."
On the screen, both men got up and traded what looked like an emotional exchange, but was probably a mutual laugh.
"Might as well get acquainted fast, Tim. They'll be seeing a lot of each other. 2nd and 7 from the 31, both teams just getting loosened up. That Bradley's a smart linebacker. He played off the center and filled the hole like he knew what was coming."
"He certainly reads his keys well for a rook, and that Viking center made the Pro Bowl last year," the color guy pointed out.
"Great ass on that Bradley kid," Daga pointed out quietly.
"This women's lib stuff is going too far, Helen," Pete said with a grin.
He shifted positions on the couch to get his service revolver out of his kidney. Gunter Bach and Marvin Russell stood on the sidewalk just outside the White House grounds among a crowd of 100 or so tourists, most of whom aimed cameras at the executive mansion. They'd arrived in the city the previous evening, and tomorrow they'd tour the Capitol. Both wore ball caps to protect them from what still felt like a summer sun. Bach had a camera draped around his neck on a Mickey Mouse strap. He snapped a few photos, mainly to blend in with the rest of the tourists. The real observations came from his trained eye. This was a much harder target than people realized. The buildings around the White House were all large enough that sharpshooters were provided with excellent perches concealed by the stonework. He knew that he was probably under surveillance right now, but they couldn't have the time or money to compare his likeness to every photo they had on their books, and he'd taken the trouble to alter his appearance enough to dispense with that worry. The president's helicopter flew in and landed only 100 meters from where he stood. A man with a man-portable SAM might stand a good chance of taking it out, except for the practical considerations. To be there at the right time was much harder than it seemed. The ideal way would be to have a small truck, perhaps one with a hole cut in the roof so that the missileer could stand, fire, and attempt his escape. Except for the rifleman, who certainly perched on the surrounding buildings, and Bach had no illusions that such snipers would miss their targets. Americans had invented sharpshooting, and their president would have the services of the best. Doubtless, some of the people in this crowd of tourists were also Secret Service agents, and it was unlikely that he'd spot them. The bomb could be driven here and detonated in a truck, depending on the protective measures that Gohn had warned him about. Similarly, he might be able to deliver the weapon by truck to the immediate vicinity of the Capitol building, perhaps at the time of the president's State of the Union address, if the weapon were ready on time. That they weren't sure of, and there was also the question of shipping it here. 3 weeks it would take. Latakia to Rotterdam, then transshipment to an American port. Baltimore was the closest major port. Norfolk, Newport News was next. Both handled lots of containerized shipping. They could fly it in, but airborne cargo was often X-rayed, and they could not risk that. The idea was to catch the president on a weekend. It almost had to be a weekend for everything else to work. Everything else. Bach knew that he was violating one of his most important operational precepts. Simplicity. But for this to have a chance of working, he had to arrange more than one incident, and he had to do it on a weekend. But the American president was in the White House only about half the time on weekends, and his movements between Washington, Ohio, and other places were unpredictable. The simplest security measure available to the president of the United States was the one they used. His movement schedule, as well known as it might have been, was irregular, and its precise details were often closely held. Bach needed at least a week's lead time to set up his other arrangements, and that was optimistic, but it would be nearly impossible to get that 7 days. It would actually have been simpler to plan a simple assassination with conventional weapons. A small aircraft, for example, might be armed with SA-7 missiles. Probably not. The president's helicopter undoubtedly had the best.